Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind.
Election time in the village, the time when every man and woman is able to vote for a leader, a vote that is free for all.
It looks like a unanimous majority.
Exactly, that's what's worrying me. Very bad for morale. Some of these good people don't seem to appreciate the value of free elections.
Everyone votes for a dictator.
Not at all. Frankly, my dear fellow, you are just the sort of candidate we need.
How are you going to handle your campaign?
No comment.
Intends to fight for freedom at all costs.
Who elected you? Whose side are you on?
Mustn't get too personal, my dear fellow.
Look at them. Brainwashed imbeciles.
The rules demand that you should undergo the test.
What is the price of his freedom and his chance to control the village? It's free for all to see in the next exciting episode of The Prisoner on this channel.
Tick, tick, and indeed other strange tick, tick sounds from, of course, our mythical language that comes through from Free for All. What do the team make of Free for All? We'll find out. But before we actually go down that route for Resonance Rewind, it's time to turn to a prisoner aficionado, scholar, and indeed somebody who's deeply connected with the series in a whole range of ways. It, of course, is Rick Davey from Quite Publishing. Rick, perhaps you'd like to just set the scene and share with the listener how you came to love this series so much.
Oh, well, the journey for me started in 1983. Channel 4 was repeating the series at that point. I was a 10-year-old. My brother knew that I liked kind of slightly odd programs. So Sapphire and Steel was one of my favorites at the time. And he's turned around and said, there's a series on Channel 4 tonight. Ask Mum if you can stay up late, because I think it was on at 10 o'clock at night. Quite late for this. Really interesting. And I was hooked from the first moment. And from then on, you know, I spent my life basically researching the production of the series, the first episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And this particular one, of course, was, I think, shot sort of at the same time as Arrival. It was the second in the production order. It was the fourth in the sequence that most folk have actually seen the 17 episodes within the whole system. Written, of course, by McGoohan himself, using the pseudonym, I think, Paddy Fitz, from that perspective. And, of course, an interesting insight in terms of the whole essence of the character of Number Six. And, of course, his relationship with Eric Portman and Rachel Herbert. And there are all manner of clues in terms of giving my regards to the homeland and areas in terms of where this could be relating to the whole process. Plus, of course, something which I still feel holds up very well when we start talking about the politics of society, contemporary politics, the democratization of society, etc. I know that this has been written about consistently by a whole variety of folk. Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens, of course, talked about maybe it was a dream. It was a whole dream sequence that we were actually having in terms of that, which explains why you see the same characters turning up as both the newspaper vendor and indeed the journalists. And of course, it's the first and only episode we actually hear the whole notion of number 113B, suggesting that maybe there's a 113A, B, C, and so on and so forth. So lots of things to talk about. Shall we try and fit that square peg into the round hole? Or shall we actually simply go for the round, meaning that you're lying, or indeed the square hole, meaning that you're square and part of society and are there? And I've just started there, Rick, with just some of the kind of textual readings you can get for this particular episode.
Absolutely. And if you listed every one, your show would probably be about 3 hours long at least. With this, you're quite right. This was one of the first episodes to be written. It was one of four episodes to be written as episode two. And as you say, McGoohan wrote this himself, and it was one of the episodes that was made in the first production block in September 1966. It featured a lot of Port Merion filming. And I've always said that if you want to show someone the ridiculousness and the corruptness of politics, show them this episode of The Prisoner, because it really does show up exactly, you know, the horrible, murky world of politics, doesn't it? And about how no matter whether you think you're in control and whether you think you're loved and whether you think the media is on your side, the opposite is probably true. And it's never been more relevant than today when you think of the current state of politics, not only in this country, but you could argue in the United States as well. And I'm sure one of your US correspondents would comment on that as well. This really does highlight so much about the world around us. And McGowan saw it all coming. And that's why it's such a fascinating watch, is that this is over 50 years old, but yet it's absolutely in tune with how the world is going today. And as you say, there are so many different things within this episode that you can analyze. You know, I don't know where to start.
Well, again, we'll try and unpick some of the sort of elements within that. I mean, the notion that when number six is introduced to the audience as good people, this is my pleasure to present to you the one and only number six, the crowd cheer, because, of course, they're being told to cheer by the butler. I am not a number, I am a person, a line very much associated with the series, to which the crowd laughs. Lots of other areas. We talked about the reporters. How are you going to handle your campaign? No comment. Intends to fight freedom for all. How about your internal policy? No comment. We'll tighten up on village security. Smile. How about external policy? No comment. Our exports will operate in every corner of the globe. It could almost be taken as a playbook for political parties around the globe, really, on that basis. And let's not forget that I know Jessica Burtis is a big fan of the Rover. Here we see the Rover in an unusual position, being watched almost as though the Rover itself is a source of entertainment, or being worshipped on an altar, as it's so. I mean, lots of things that are being thrown in here, including, of course, that false language, which, of course, I used to spend thinking, well, is B seeing you translate it to this Eastern European sounding thing like that? And of course, it wasn't even like Klingonese. It just was nonsense, although effectively delivered. And I have to say, from a personal point of view, I was really impressed as the years have gone by with the actress Rachel Herbert, who portrays number 58. And I mean, Rick, do you know what happened to Rachel Herbert? I know she went on to do various other bits and pieces, but it struck me as somebody who managed to switch so completely from the supposed overseas Eastern European agent, the assistant for number six, of course, to the notion of, will he never learn?
Rachel Herbert was fantastic in this. And she actually, what she did was, it is a made up language. McGowan totally invented all the words that you hear in the episode. But what she did, she had a friend from Yugoslavia and she went round to her house with a tape recorder and said, just keep speaking these into this tape recorder. And she took the recording home of her friend speaking in this sort of Slavic tongue and basically, you know, really concentrated for days on end, learning all the different vowel sounds so that she would sound totally convincing as a foreigner in this episode. And she gives a great performance. I'm happy to say that Rachel Herbert is still with us, along with Darren Nesbitt. She's the only surviving number two actor from the series. Although, have I given a spoiler away there, that at the end of the episode, that's what she becomes, but I hope nobody minds the spoilers. And she's very much still with us. She kind of did disappear from acting a little bit, kind of as you get towards the end of the 80s, but she had some really memorable appearances in things like Lord Peter Wimsey. She was in an episode of Danger Man, of course, which I think is where McGowan first encountered her. And she does an excellent job. And the one negative about this episode is that I wanted to see another episode with her in it, in her switched character, you know, her, yes, her evil personified number two. I'd have loved to have seen an entire episode with her at the helm as number two. But you raised so many wonderful aspects of the episode there. You know, the fact that they're laughing at him, saying, I'm not a number, I'm a person. That's kind of a metaphor for the whole series, isn't it? Mm. He's an individual and he's not allowed to be an individual. And he's telling us that none of us are individuals. You know, we're all prisoners of this society that we live in, that we build for ourselves, and that we cannot be individuals. And I do wonder whether that strange Rover worshipping scene at the end, my theory is that it ties into that, in that they're shown worshipping that which controls us, because Rover is there obviously to shepherd and herd people about and keep them under control. And we're taught in society, aren't we, almost to worship people. You know, we think of the royal family, you know, we're to doff our caps and, you know, tug our forelocks for the royal family. And to politicians, you know, you know, someone that's been to Eton is presented to us as being more important than someone who went to Halifax Comprehensive, when everybody is as equally as important as each other. But we're almost conditioned, aren't we, to worship that which controls us. And I think that's the point that McGowan was making throughout the episode. And the little people, you know, I think the fact that they were 113 and 113B, I think that was that was McGowan's way of saying, look, these are just normal working people. But they're not as important. They're half a person, because they're not as important as a politician. I think that was the point that he was making. And it's a great scene, isn't it, with him writing McGowan's answers for him, even though he said no comment to all the questions. That's how the media behaves, isn't it? They make up their own stories. It doesn't matter what the real story is. And that's my take on it anyway.
So let's talk characters. I mean, honestly, it's going to be a real challenge to actually sort through, I would have thought, a single favourite character in terms of this. But for you, Rick, who would actually get your honourable mentions and indeed receive the award for being best character? I mean, would it be one of the... George Benson, we haven't mentioned his role as the Labour Exchange manager, who, of course, has his wonderful tea and his approach at the end when Patrick McGowan says, of course, you will be voting for me, won't you, after he's had that brainwashing treatment. Eric Portman, of course, again, a wonderful... avuncular number two, but a number two who clearly is very much part of the system. And again, arguably, that crossover between Portman's number two and Rachel Herbert's number two also opened this up. But you know, again, the classic line of Portman saying, you know, vote for me and we'll be ever so comforty. And the pub that they go into in the end to deal with the hooch and the switch from the character of Portman, where we see him very much portrayed as somebody who seems as though he's basically almost having a nervous breakdown. And suddenly he switches completely once number six effectively collapses. And we realise, again, it's the facade that we see that actually was there. It was all just a lie from that point of view. Anyway, your favourite characters, please, Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great little cast. It's not a massive cast for this episode, but it's a great little cast. From the reporter, Harold Behrens, does a great little turn. According to him, he came back for a later episode. The way he tells it is that McGowan asked him on because he wanted someone to bring laughter to the set. Which is why Harold Behrens was asked on. You know, he was a big star of It's That Man Again back in the 50s.
I'm sure Annette Andre would have one or two things to say about that, but that's another issue for another time.
Absolutely. I think Eric Portman delivers a really sinister performance. He's so affable, isn't he, as a character, you think, but underneath, you know, there is pure evilness there. And I think he delivers a lovely performance, because at that point he was very ill. He died, I think, 2 years later or a year later. And when he was doing his sequences in Port Merion, he had to read his lines from idiot boards, from cue cards, because he was so poorly by that point. But he still delivers a really nice performance where you're sympathetic to him, but you know that there's that evilness behind that. George Benson, yes, that's a great little part. He has John Casaubon as the man in the little pub in the cave, I think delivers a really interesting performance. I'd love to have known more about his character. You know, we're given these little tidbits, aren't we, about who these people are and how they end up in the village, but we're never given their full backstory. I think he delivers that nicely. But my favourite character is Rachel Herbert's number 58 /
Well, we have to say we're in agreement with respect to that.
It's one of the finest performances of the series.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, and it's really in contrast to her real life personality. She's such a lovely, lovely lady in real life. I've had the pleasure of meeting her once, and she was really, really lovely and affable. A far cry from that steely woman you see at the end of the episode, who you know you wouldn't want to cross on a dark night.
Indeed. So a score out of 10 then for Free for All.
I think this is the first time I've done this on your show. It's a 10 out of 10. I think The Prisoner is a near perfect series, and I cannot find fault with this episode. I think it's a superb allegory of the world we live in, beautifully constructed, directed and performed.
And for people who wish to actually follow your excellent work, where should they actually go?
You can follow The Unmutual website is the website that I'm involved with. And that is theunmutual.co.uk. If you search Facebook, Twitter and Instagram for Unmutual, that will come up. And you can follow there and find out all the latest news, publications and sort of weekly facts about the series. You can learn a bit more. We'll be right back.
So where are we going to go? If people have actually had a listen to Rick Davey, you will have if you've been listening to this in chronological order, of course, you'll know what Rick's views about Free For All were, and pretty much high they were indeed. Is it a guide to the election scenario of the 21st century? Is it something which still resonates? We're going to find out over the next few moments. Let's jump straight into Cathy Manso. Cathy, have you encountered the prisoner before? Have you seen any episodes before? Was it something which you thought, this is bizarre? Or share with us your experience.
This was the first time I ever watched it. You know, I was new, as they would say. And I really got confused within the first 5 minutes when they introduced the side character, because I thought I just couldn't understand the British accent. And then I was like, oh, no, it's just a different language. So I had to replay it a few times and be like, no, it's not me. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
Lietziena, or what was it to that effect, as indeed Rachel Herbert simply actually worked on the made up language by actually listening to how her neighbor, who happened to be Yugoslavian, actually spoke. It's a whole new world. Phil, I know you're a keen appreciator of the Prisoner series. You are indeed director Phil Leonis. You've encountered a whole range of folks, including Alexis Kanner, who was part of this series, etc. What were your thoughts on this one, as indeed you proudly portraying the official badge of office, the official penny farthing bicycle upon your person?
Yes, although I'm also remaining my individuality, right? I mean, Patrick, who I was friends with, as you know, I always wondered when they would have conventions of the prisoner at Port Merion and everyone would dress up in the characters. I always wondered, he must hate this. Like, this is exactly what he was arguing against doing. Maintain your individuality. So, although I wear the swag from Port Merion, I, of course, also represent bad like Jimmy Cliff. So I'm still me. I'm still a person, as he would say. Look, this show has famously been called the most intelligent, thought-provoking entertainment series ever created. And this episode, out of the 17, is one of the seven that, according to McGoohan himself, actually matter. Not that the others don't matter. He was always flinty about it. But he would have loved to have done a seven-episode miniseries. And so to him, thematically, the allegory gets told in seven episodes. And you're dropping people like Kathy, unfortunately, into the metaphor kind of far along in the game already, even though it's only episode four. Indeed, it probably felt like a free-for-all for Kathy, trying to fight her way through all the confusion. But I will say, boy, this opening of this episode still thrills to this day, where the dialogue is some of the best ever written by McGoohan himself, though he was so unsure of himself still as a writer that he used a pseudonym. He wasn't unsure of himself as a director. He gave himself credit for that. But he used his mother's maiden name, Fitzpatrick, broke it up. Patty Fitz is who we end up with as the writer. And some of those exchanges of dialogue, are we going to play it according to Hoyle, all cards on the table? Are you going to run like blazes, first chance I get? I mean, such wonderful exchanges, and it all thrills, and the parodies and the satires of elections, of the media, of print journalism, they still resonate to this day.
Well, let's turn to somebody who is not unfamiliar with the series, because she's seen Arrival, she's seen a couple of lines there. She's, of course, shared the one with the wonders of Annette Andre, and basically, and she loves the Rovers. So, Jessica Burtis, you should have been in your element here, given that we're still not sure whether we worship the Rover, whether the Rover is actually there as something that we actually follow through, whether it's guarding us. What's going on with respect to that? Jessica, your thoughts on Free For All, please.
Yeah, I was very excited to get back into this show and to see the Rovers again, who they are everything that is in this show. They are the main characters, let's be honest. But I thought it was nice seeing the side characters having some interesting drama going on. I thought it was a really good episode. I mean, they're always very interesting, and I I should just go ahead and just binge all the episodes because I think this little bubble of a world is so fascinating and why they're there and who these people are. And I think this one had a really interesting, like, the plot twist at the end came out of absolutely nowhere. And the accent, I thought, like, hearing about the language that was created, kind of like the way that they made the language, that 58 was kind of her accent. And hearing how Rick was explaining how long she took learning it, was just really interesting. I like that there was so much paid attention to small details with that. So I thought it was really good, actually.
Okay, so there we have it, Pamela. Some reasons already why you should possibly actually work and look through this. But Phil, back to yourself. I mean, we heard there about obviously Rachel Herbert, who I've already said is my favorite character from this particular episode. And I share what Rick said, that I would have liked her to have actually had a whole episode as number two herself when she did that
So
switch.
keen viewers would already have been prepared for this switch because we have had the woman confidant revealed as the quote unquote villain of the episode in the past already. Something that would recur again and again. There's an unfortunate line that Patrick McGoohan has, or that number six has. He's very chivalric. He's sometimes almost proto-feminist, but he does say in one of the episodes, you can never trust a woman, even the four-legged variety. And that is a theme that runs throughout this show, the untrustworthy nature of women. And so that's clue number one. Secondly, in the opening credits, which still, by the way, don't they thrill? Don't those thrill with the music and the zoom shots? Fantastic. But he wakes up in the village and we hear the traditional exchange between number two and number six. Where am I? In the village, right? And this episode, the voice is not of someone who ever played number two in a series. It's the generic number two voice. Most episodes, the exchange will be with whomever is playing number two in that episode. This time it's a generic voice, never seen as number two. Those episodes where it's generic generally is a hint that number two is not who you think it is in those shows. So again, a clue that we're given that there's going to be a twist handy. The other thing, the Rover, yes, the cult. We get to see the cult of Rover in this. And that's always been weird to me. Like, what does it mean? And now, all these years later, Rover being such an obvious, what was the word Jessica just used? Bubble, living in this bubble. What better to represent society and the smothering, suffocating nature of society than an actual bubble? And yes, people worship at the cult of society. They really do. And so, what do? Do you reject society or do you worship at the cult of society? Or is there a third path? And this show would argue, yes, there's a third path. However, as long as you care, as long as you care about people, you will always be a prisoner. You will never truly be free because you care. And that's a choice for you to make, which is why at the beginning, he has not retired. He is resigned, not resigned. He is resigned to his fate.
Kathy, it's always a delight to hear Phil's masterclass in terms of a certain text that we actually work through here. Does that help shed a little bit more light on the significance of a series, which it has to be said, Robin Pierce can't stand and doesn't really like Patrick McGoohan?
Well, I mean the themes are obvious. It was this utopia or dystopia, depending on your perspective, was really apparent. And you relate very quickly, like, oh, how great to choose a candidate that doesn't really want to be a candidate. Those are typically the ideal situations that in society today we would kind of want. And how, I mean, the just seeing like the newspaper written up and the focus of questions and what's being answered and not answered. And also the characters, like, you can see he's consciously trying really hard to fight this general consensus, this overwhelming agreement. Like he, it's not that he doesn't want to agree, but he wants the truth more importantly, you know, whatever version of the truth is. And I don't think he's prepared to realize that he might not like that version either, which I think we've all kind of found ourselves in a situation very similar to that. You know, you may want to keep seeking for something. And then once you find out the answer, you're like, ooh, maybe ignorance was a little bit bliss at that point. So I did, and that's it. It was an episode, even though I was thrown into the middle of it, it wasn't too difficult. I mean, I just took the episode as what it was, whatever was presented to me. I accepted the world very quickly. And I said, okay, we're in it. Like, let's go. And it is a story that keeps on going on and continuing where you don't really know, like, it captivates you. You want to see how it's going to turn out and what's going to happen. And like, you know, Jessica said, the twist, brutal.
And presumably also the way in which words are twisted, the notion of what would you do with your spare time if you had it? I have no spare time. You're here, you're working to your own limit. How do you actually work? What would you do with spare time? More work, less play. More play, less work. Slogans, which are essentially meaningless, but surely politicians have worked on that basis of slogans, certainly for the recent set of electoral
sessions.
Well, and
have you ever heard teachers talk to each other? Like, they'll ask each other, like, oh, how are you doing? I'm here. Oh, how are things? It's keeping on, just keeping on. Like, you have these phrases that you respond back to, but you're like, I really can't give you the real answer right now because we'd have to sit down for like an hour for me to go through it.
How about obey me and be free? Obey and be free. That's one that's quite popular in even the Democratic West, it seems, these days. We need a strong man to keep us free.
Man.
Yeah, so go back to yourself. Any particular characters other than the Rover, for whom obviously I'm sure you'll give an honorable mention, that stood out to yourself? I mean, we talked a lot about Eric Portman's characterization of Number Two. Of course, there's Angela Muscat as the butler, the labor exchange manager, George Benson.
George Benson.
Of course. Yes. Not the soul
singer,
good. Pamela.
So good in comedies with Alec Guinness throughout the years. He's wonderful. I mean, those are little short films, but his little scene with Magoon, oh my goodness. What a masterclass he's putting on.
With tea, of course. And you will vote for me, naturally. The whole range of things. Anyway, Jessica.
You and only you.
Indeed. Jessica, what's, again, stood out character-wise for you?
I think it is number 58, number two, because I think she kind of just brought an outside, it felt like an outside element to it, where for a second, it's somebody different from the status quo that's kind of established among this little place. And it feels like a disruption. And, you know, it feels like there's a suspense to it that I think is very particular to this show, because so much of it is built around the suspense of why are they here? Lack of information. We don't know much. So I think then when you get information, it's done through a twist where she's actually not who she seems to be. It throws you for even bigger loop because you didn't just get information. It's just completely counter to what you had previously been given. So I kind of like that. It felt like a little bit of a betrayal by the writers to kind of keep us alert. And I thought that she was just very interesting as a character. Again, like everybody in the show feels very mysterious. So I'm always wondering where they come from, what their goals are. So she's no different. But then being number two just adds like another dynamic to it.
Well, you know, maybe Eric Portman, I don't know if you've already talked about the historic importance of him, especially in the history of UK cinema, but so famously beloved for his work in three films by Powell and Pressburger, perhaps the greatest of all British filmmakers, and always playing a very mysterious, duplicitous character in their films. That's what he was most closely identified with. So to be able to see him as number two, He was just one of a string of great actors, great and famous actors, who said yes to playing these figures of number two, while not honestly being given much of a character. They're given a job of number two, but it's up to the actor to really inform any idea of who these people are. And so to have Eric Portman with that notoriety and that association that audiences at the time would have had, oh my goodness, how powerful that must have been to see on television for the first time.
Kathy, it has been suggested by Professor Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens that you could read this episode as simply a dream, which might explain the spontaneity and why certain characters reoccur. And we see number 180, 113B turning up as 113A and so on, that there is a kind of blend to the system of that. Any thoughts on your characters?
Oh, man. You know, I was thinking as I was watching it, and I mean, I like who Jessica called out because I did really appreciate her appearing, but I'm going to give a shout out to the journalist who would just jump into the car, and rightfully so. Number six was about to punch him for jumping into the car and somehow had the restraint to be like, ah, I see. The press, maybe I don't want to punch the journalist or the photographer, whoever he had in his hands. I just kind of enjoyed that he was like, yeah, sure, sit along for the ride. Let me answer your questions without answering your questions. And they kind of kept appearing in the theme. What number were they? Like 113A,
113B. Mm. Again, are they just little people? Harold Burns playing the reporter and Dean Cooper playing the photographer. Or were they essentially a bit like Holly Doon as the waitress who's serving just like vodka, just like certain alcoholic things, tastes the same, smells the same, but it non-alcoholic? Pamela, you suggested the Cult of Rover as a great band name. Have you been bemused and confused by what you've been listening to? Or is it a case of, well, surely I have to speak to Jerry, my husband, and see if he's ever accessed the prisoner?
You know, this is something I recommend. Not that I recommend people being errant. However, if you have not watched something and you know nothing about it, you have no historical background, you don't even know any of the actors, like nothing. And then you come on to one of these incredible Resonance Rewind sessions. It really makes you want to watch the thing, even if it's not good. Or we don't know if it's good or not good. But I want to watch it now. And I love the fact, wait, what did I write? Okay. Number six is again repeatedly drugged and coerced into accepting the campaign and wins the election when virtually all the robotic citizens vote for him. I mean, that's fantastic. So I really shouldn't even be talking because I don't know what the bleep I'm talking about. But I love hearing you guys all talk about it, and I miss you all, and you're making me want to watch it.
Well, the curious thing, of course, is after the election, it literally just goes dead. It's almost as though having had that election, having had that victory, having had that exercise of democracy, suddenly it's all over. We'll forget it until the next time, basically. And there's no suggestion that there's anything else other than that. Another one of those switches that occur within the actual episode itself from that point of view. As we said in the classic line, vote for me and you'll be ever so comforty. A line which I do quite like from that point of view, when, of course, Eric Portman is portraying somebody who seems as though he's on the edge of a nervous breakdown. But, of course, there's another switch there. Lots of kind of changes around with respect to that. Phil, anything you'd like to add before we ask for your favourite character?
Yes, you know, this episode, more than most, I think because it had such specific targets and expressed so much of McGoohan's own personal animosities. You know, that idea of his impulse to punch the press and instead simply be surly and unlikable with them was him. And that's how he would be in all his interviews. It as a result, part of there, I grow increasingly disturbed by this episode for a reason, which is when Pat made this, he wanted people to think about You know, the spy, the love of spy adventure of the 60s, and which brought him his fame and fortune, of course. But he wanted to people to think that it was all well and good to believe that a clandestine war of ideals was being fought in the shadows on our behalf. But if it could be fought in the shadows on our behalf, it could also be used against us. That anything that operates in the shadows needs to be exposed to the light. He also had similar concerns with television. A media that can bring us close together can also serve to rob us of our individual thought. And those are valid and universal themes. What I have witnessed, I must say, not just, of course, in culture, but with fans of this show, the cult that has surrounded this show, of which I am a card-carrying member, that cynicism has been what has persisted and amplified. And we find it expressed today in very, very challenging ways, where the takeaway is that you must not trust institutions or your fellow people. And that leads us, I think, in no small part to where we are, where fascism can find it a lot easier to take hold, because we don't trust anything. So this episode, I think, really is very dark to me in that way.
And there was the suggestion, of course, that originally the draft was that clearly Danger Man / secret agent, depending on which side of the Atlantic you were watching, Patrick McGoohan's incarnation of John Drake, who may or may not have actually been the prisoner or number six. We never quite know from that point of view.
Except... Can I just say, I mean, that has to do with legal things, and they didn't have the rights to the character, but it was originally pitched to ITV as a sequel series because they didn't want to let him out of his contract, Patrick McGoohan. So George Markstein said, well, what if your character wanted to resign the way you as an actor do? Could they let him out of his contract? And hence the premise was born. But I once watched a rebroadcast on CBS of this series. This is probably 20 years ago. And in the middle of the night, I called up Patrick because I knew he was always up in the middle of the night writing. And it had suddenly occurred to me how autobiographical this show was. And that in the very last episode, spoiler alert free, we won't tell you what happened, but in the end credits, as is traditional, right, you might show an actor, a character, and the name of the actor who played it. And they do that with, like, the butler giving him his own title card, Angelo Muscat, and some of the other people. But when they show number six, instead of saying Patrick McGoohan, it just says the prisoner at the very end of the show. And I called him and I said, you know, you used to say you wished someone else could play this part, but this is actually about you. It's not about a fictional character, John Drake. It's not about fictional. This is you and what you were wrestling with at the time. And that's why you describe yourself as prisoner. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of chuckled with that whimsical way that he had and said, that's very insightful. And that was the end of the conversation.
Yeah, certainly, again, it's we appreciate your input from that point of view, Phil, because it's always nice to actually hear McGoohan's thoughts. And I'm sure if he's looking down, who'll be sort of saying, no, they've got it all wrong. It was all about a retirement home for agents from both sides of the Atlantic. And basically that's what the whole thing was working on.
He may be throwing in a, you rotten vegetables.
Yes. Okay, let's talk numbers. Kathy, what's your score for this particular episode of The Prisoner? Episode 4, although it was the second that really was shot. So again, working through that process, whilst they were still shooting, I think, Arrival, the first episode, what are you going to award this out of 10?
I feel like I would have given it a higher score if I understood, like if I'd seen the episode before and things like that. So, but I still really was entertained by it and probably will continue on. So I'm giving it a solid 7.
Solid 7 from Kathy. Jessica, what's your score going to be?
I think it's an 8. I think this is probably my favorite episode so far. So I like this one quite a lot.
Again, I still think it has an awful lot to say in terms of how politics, maybe as Phil's rightly said, has changed and adjusted within the whole thing. We haven't really spoken about the music, of course. I mean, Ron Grainer's theme very much to the fore here, but we also had some wonderful musical aspects that were being brought into play within the system. I mean, you know, given the sort of the notion of how music is developed, Albert Elms, Ron Grainer, and Eric Mivelle. But Albert Elms doing incidental music with this. It does work, Phil, I think, to actually give that kind of holistic feel to the, I mean, Port Merion is, of course, a real place. People can actually go to Port Merion and actually see the base of the Prince, where it was actually filmed. All the things are actually in there. It appeared initially in Danger Man.
And honestly, how much do we think Robin Pierce not liking this is because he lives there? He's in Port Merion, for crying out loud. But boy, it cannot be understated what an important character the location is. I mean, it's again, I said masterclass about the acting earlier. It's a film school course on how important it is to turn your locations into a character. That if you don't get a sense of a place, and let's face it, most movies and TV shows we watch don't take advantage of that powerful opportunity. But man, when it works, you never forget it. The place becomes indelible.
Who would you have voted for, Jessica? Number two or number six?
I mean, number six, right? You have to.
Kathy, would you have gone number six or would you have gone number two? Who obviously was playing a line of maybe these newfangled ideas, these new notions need to be watched, carefully monitored, really.
I mean, as a, you know, personally, I don't trust any politicians, but I think between the two, I would have picked a six.
And Phil, your score out of 10 for this one?
Oh my goodness. Wow. You didn't ask me who I would have voted for.
Well, who would you have voted for then?
Six or two, and two for nothing, and six for free, for all, for free, for all. Vote. Vote. Like, all they say is that it's just important to vote. And don't we hear that all the time? Oh, it doesn't matter who you vote for. Just go vote. Meanwhile, we're going to try to prevent you from voting. And Pat, by the way, would have been very much of the opinion, don't vote. It only encourages them. Anyway, I'm going to say actually an eight. What is brilliant about this show is some of the best that television has ever had to offer. McGoohan himself demonstrating not just brilliant writing and wonderful direction, but also, oh, by the way, while doing that and executive producing the show, he gives a great performance in this. Can we talk about when he goes from his usual sort of surly distrusting to suddenly being happy and charming? That sudden pivot and how he does it is delightful. So it's a wonderful showcase for him. It is critically important to the understanding of the allegory, to understanding what motivated this series in the first place. That said, I think that the high points, especially at the beginning, are so thrilling that there are moments where upon repeat viewings, not first viewings, but upon repeat viewings, I'm kind of going, okay, yeah, I remember all this now. This I all remember. Whereas there's other episodes that came before, like Chimes of Big Ben, that only get better every single time you watch it. And this, I don't think, does that. And again, the cynicism that permeates, that I think has grown exponentially in no small part because of shows like this, I can only give it an eight.
Mm. Interesting, of course, in the poster campaigns for number six, we see an image of Patrick McGoohan, arguably very much taken from his time in the Danger Man / Secret Agent series of John Drake, which again was another reason I think people have actually said it is one of the same, obviously.
I want that poster. I have this whole desire to create a collection of artwork that exists inside the worlds of movies. So artwork that characters have, and then, you know, and that's what I kind of would love to decorate with. And that a vote for number six, vote number six, is a poster I would love to have. Yeah.
Did you give a favorite character, Phil? I couldn't remember whether you had or hadn't.
Oh my goodness. My favorite character. This is, you know what, let's go with George Benson as the labor exchange manager, because, you know, everybody else, you know, had such a more important, let's say, role to play. And here's just a character actor who never got to play the lead in any movies, any TV shows, who just comes in as a day player and just knocks it out of the park. And God, I love people like that, who are just so good. They have no business being that good. And they are just a phenomenal. And I love supporting players because, as you know, to me, what are they supporting? They're supporting our belief in the world we're watching. We'll follow lead actors if and actresses if they're interesting, funny, attractive, scary, you know, strong. We'll follow them. But we only believe the world if we believe those supporting people inhabiting it. And he's one of those people that we believe.
I think I shall score this at a 9. Not quite as high as Rick Davies' 10 out of 10, but still something because it does connect with the whole expression of where we are. Pamela, has this tempted you to seek out The Prisoner and Patrick McGoohan?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, there we are. Because I have to say, you're wearing a wonderful top, which could actually be taken directly from one of the main characters and much of the fashion design in The Prisoner, really, with the stripes from that point of view on there. Not prison stripes, but interesting sort of horizontal stripes.
Again, Alex, I think maybe there are no accidents. You know, I think something was transmitted to me. I mean, why did I tune in not having done my homework? You know, maybe it was
because
just
there's always a place for your good self, Pamela. Next week, arguably a movie which probably owes everything to The Prisoner, as Andrew Niccol might possibly say, featuring, of course, Jim Carrey in the lead role. It's The Truman Show. True man, as in real man, or in a whole range of other experiences from that point of view. But yes, that's where we're heading down as far as Residence Rewired is concerned next week. The Truman Show. For now, though, to Rick Davey earlier, to Phil Learness, to Pamela Mann, Pamela Suman, and to Kathy Manso and Jessica Burtis, of course. Should we just say lights of Ona? I've never got the lights of Ona. Be seeing you? I don't know. How should we go out? Phil, you have the chair on this one.
If we can't go out with rah, 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 the cue cards that always come up, well, then I think it has to be seeing you.
Thank you.
What happens if I run against you?
I might as well while I'm waiting.
Delightful.
What physically happens if I win?
You're the boss.
Number one's the boss. Put us all into solitary confinement and you get what you're after and have done with it.
That's enough! I call this meeting to order!
Look at them.
Brainwashed imbeciles. Can you laugh? Can you cry? Can you think? Is this what they did to you? Is this how they tried to break you till they got what they were after?
In your heads must still be the remnant of a brain. In your hearts must still be the desire to be a human being again.
This is a most serious breach of etiquette. I'd imagine your desire to stand for election was genuine.
Will you never learn? This is only the beginning. We have many ways and means, but we don't wish to damage you permanently. Are you ready to talk?